Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler, appropriately enough, that is my name. It is March the 14th, 2014. The time is just flying by, spring hopefully on the horizon. I welcome you all to my program where we play that game of catch-up at the end of the week, and boy, oh boy, as they say, what a week it has been. Those of you new to my program, let me introduce myself to you. I'm a former senior special agent of what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the INS, an agency that no longer exists. It was replaced by an outfit known as ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and also by Customs and Border Protection, CBP, under this umbrella of DHS, an agency that our government refers to as the Department of Homeland Security. I refer to it as the Department of Homeland Surrender, and we certainly are surrendering an awful lot these days, aren't we? I have two websites I'm very much concerned with, and I'd love for you to visit. First, my own personal website, michaelcutler.net, C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. And also, for quite some time now, I am pleased to have been appointed as a senior fellow with a great organization known as CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization. Their website is capsweb.org. We'll talk a bit about them later on. But there's a guest that I'm about to bring on, and this guy has a has served this country in ways that are just incredible. General Vallely, happy Friday. Thank you so much for joining me today on the Michael Cutler Hour.
Well, thank you, Mike. I can be with you a short time. I've unfortunately been in an emergency room with a friend of mine.
Oh, my goodness. And, I hope he's okay.
Well, he's fine. He had an aortic dissection, so I had to come and be with him. So I've been on the road for 4 hours. But listen, I wasn't going to cancel on you today, but I'll be happy to spend as much time as I can.
I want you to know how much that means to me. You know, General Vallely spent 32 years serving this country, so I really have to start out by thanking you for all you've done for us on behalf of everybody out there, my listeners and all Americans. We owe you an amazing debt of gratitude, you and your family. I know your son made the supreme sacrifice as a soldier as well. You exemplify what being a great American is all about, General Vallely.
Well, thank you, Mike. Yesterday was Scott's 39th birthday, and we lost him in Special Forces in 2004. So what's going on in our country and what's going on with the armed forces is very important to me, and I get up every day and try to change things to get back to the way we can be proud of our country again and fix all the undoings that are going on.
You know, I know that you're very much involved with the organization known as Stand Up America. Why don't we start with that, and then I want to ask you at least a few questions about the ongoing Malaysia Airlines situation, and if we have more time, there's other questions. Otherwise, you know, I certainly understand that you have an emergency to deal with.
Well, that's fine, Michael. Yeah, we can talk. You want to talk first about national security and the military?
I'll tell you what, you're my guest, so you get to pick. And you outranked me. I was only a 13 in the Army. I would have been the equivalent of a lieutenant colonel. You were a major general, so you get to pick. How's that?
Well, thank you, Michael. Well, I was fortunate enough, the poor young Irish kid out of near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to go to West Point and get a degree there and then go on through a 32-year career. But when I look back at all the combat time that I had as well as peacetime in the schools. And, you know, I look at our strategy now in a country which is severely lacking. We seem not to have any people of common sense or understanding strategy anymore. And so to get involved in these wars without a strategy to win. And so I'm very upset with that. So we need leadership back in our government. We need leadership in the Pentagon, the CIA, State Department, the White House can lead this country. Because, as you know, we're downgrading now again, just like we did after Vietnam. We're gutting the Army. The morale is at its lowest that it's been in a long time. As the rest of the world, I would say our adversaries, when you look at Iran, you look at North Korea, you look at China, you look at Russia, they're building up, getting stronger. And guess who the prime target is? The United States. So,
well, we're the biggest guy in the we're the big guy in the alley. And, you know, the old story is if a bunch of guys are coming at you, you take on the biggest one first. If you can knock him out, you don't have to worry about the other ones.
Well, that's exactly right. They see what weak leadership we have, and they see the failure of us to really achieve any victories. We haven't had a victory since World War II.
Yep. Yeah, police actions are not what the Army was for.
Resources. Yeah. We've got a border problem, as you know. We've got domestic security threats. We have external security threats. We have Iran now putting ships and their part of their fleet into the Atlantic for the first time, trying to check out exactly what's going on in their minds to attack the grid system of the United States.
So now that you've mentioned Iran, it's okay. I'll let that pass for a moment. Now you've mentioned Iran, and by the way, I have to tell you, I was looking at your resume. You know, if three people accomplished what you accomplished, they would have had full careers, I have to tell you. I was struck by something else. Right now the president is determined to raise the wages of people in the civilian sector, and I'm very much compassionate about labor, which is why I'm a Democrat. But what he's doing is destroying the military. He's raising the price of housing, cutting military benefits. It seems as though the people upon whose shoulders we rest our country are taking it in the neck or some other part of their anatomies, while everyone else is going to get a freebie from this administration. And that contrast disturbs me, and as a former general, I'm going to have to imagine it infuriates you because it's got me very upset. Am I getting that wrong, by the way?
Well, no, you're not getting it wrong. You know, the Veterans Administration, the corruption and what's going on there, the changes that need to be made to provide what we promised these soldiers, these wounded veterans and their families, those are being cut. You know, we have a tremendous amount of our enlisted people that are on food stamps. That's not right. So when you look at downsizing and gutting the Army, sure, there's a lot of waste in the Pentagon, we all know that. There's changes I would go in there and make, but it certainly wouldn't be the people. It'd be some of these programs that we don't need, the extensive and very large bureaucracy that we have within the armed forces. I would restructure the entire command chain and command system of the armed forces.
To streamline it, I would guess.
Oh, absolutely. I was told, I'll give you a good example. Early 2000s, when I was with Fox News and started to cover Afghanistan, we went into Afghanistan, sought out the Taliban, 34 days, 100 paramilitary and special ops guys with air power, busted the back of the Taliban and sent them fleeing across the border.
Now, into Pakistan.
When
you say across the border, for my listeners, you mean
into Pakistan.
Right.
Correct. Flushed them out. And then we started to go in building bases, which my good friend Colonel Najjar told me, Lebanese Christian colonel. He said, make sure you don't put any bases into the Middle East. He said, the bases in the Middle East will be a giant sponge,
yep,
historically to what the Middle East is. It will soak up every asset you put into it, financial as well as human. And so when I look at Iraq now, all the money, all of the blood, all the,
yep,
wounded, over 50,000, for,
wow,
what? For nothing. No return to the United States. And we're going to see the same thing in Afghanistan. So without a strategy to win, and again, the war against radical Islam is an unconventional war. That's the way you fight it. And you fight them for what I call lily pads. You find the target. If they're a threat against the United States, go in and take them out just like we did in Afghanistan. And you come back,
right,
home. But it's a matter of generals and admirals now not having the right strategy.
Where do you think that's coming from? Why is it that we don't have the strategists we used to?
Well, because they work for political appointees and civilians that have no idea how to fight a war.
But what was different during the Second World
charge.
War? And I know you're a lecturer as well. I mean, your background is beyond belief. But going back to the Second World War, they worked for civilians also. Our government was founded on the idea of civilians calling the shots, literally and figuratively.
Well, that That's right, but we did have some people that had some knowledge, but they had the common sense to let the generals, if we're going to go to war to win, go to win early and get back home. But you had leaders then, even Roosevelt. He let MacArthur, he let Patton, he let Eisenhower win those two wars. And we won those wars, the largest wars against anybody against the United States, in 3 years and 10 months. So
it
tells you about the even the Democrats back then. You had the Scoop Jacksons. These people understood the importance of national security, and they did have some military background. These guys, they have none. Obama has none. Clinton has none.
I have to ask you this question.
Bush was in the National Guard.
I have to ask you this question.
Bush was in the National Guard, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, here's my question, because and I've made this point, because, you know, my issue, of course, is when the enemy gets up close and in person, which is what immigration and what I call the Department of Homeland Surrender is all about, the way they run things. I thought you'd appreciate that. But, you know, in a matter of speaking, is it not true that the primary mission of all of the military was to keep our enemy as far from our shores as possible? So, in effect, your job was to do border security, but at a distance.
Secure America and secure the American people.
Doesn't it make sense? So up close and in person, if DHS fails at its mission, no matter what sacrifices, gallantry, or even if we did have good leadership, doesn't that kind of all get erased when DHS fails to step up to the plate? Because I want people to understand that this is no less a mission of America's survival than what the Army does.
Well, look at, they put Janet Napolitano in charge of Homeland Security. She knew nothing about security. She's never served in the armed forces. Now they got a lawyer in there. The Homeland Security Department is one of the first departments I would get away, I would do away with, and I would reposition the border forces back into the military under the Department of Defense.
And then
so
we've got to deal with interior. And how would you deal with interior enforcement? That would be a great conversation for you and me to sit down over a cold one, because we've got to look at interior enforcement that they're absolutely ignoring now.
That's what the National Guard is for. That is what local, county law enforcement is all about. That's why the states were given the National Guard, to provide that for the states. So there's a lot of things that can be done from the even the active armed forces. I wrote a paper on border security on the South 3 years ago, and I said we should position what I call special ops launch units, that if we targeted any cartels, we would tell Mexico, basically, if you have any cartels or you have illegal people coming in that have targeted the United States in any way, such as a lot of the Al-Qaeda that are coming across the border and others, that we target, you tell Mexico, we're going to put in a 20-kilometer no-go zone. We find anything on the 20-kilometer no-go zone, they're what we call rich targets, and we'll take them out.
It's target practice.
So that's the way you defend your border. And if you have a country that is not holding up their end, then you have to take measures to push that border out where you can look down, see down, and, in fact, put in armed forces to take out those targets. I mean, it's a crime what they've been doing to those cities along the border, to the Mexicans, for example.
Oh,
and
Mexican
police have pulled out. The armed forces can't do it, but they're directly on our border and affecting what's going on in the United States. So anyhow, Michael, it takes a lot of creative, innovative, strategic planning. But if you have the right people, the right leadership, I could put together a task force now, 25 people, including you, and we could solve this whole border immigration issue.
Well, I'll tell you, it would certainly be a privilege to work under your command. Now, let me just quickly get, because I'm looking at the clock, and I want to be careful that I don't keep you too long, and I am going to get you back. I mean, with your background.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, as I say, it's a privilege to have you on the program this evening. I'm looking at the Malaysian airline situation, and we have two Iranians on board with fake passports, and what's mind-boggling to me is we keep expanding the visa waiver program. The 9/11 Commission, you know, came out and said that the visa process was so flawed that the terrorists that attacked us on 9/11 and other terrorists were able to get visas. So now we keep expanding the process by which aliens come in without visas. So European passports are in high demand. One was carrying an Italian passport. The other was carrying an Austrian passport. And it's remarkable to me that they just added Chile to the list of visa waiver countries. We're now up to 38 countries. There were 26 on 9/11, 38 now. We're going backwards. And now with this airplane, what would you consider the most probable scenario, and what would you consider the worst case scenario? And hopefully you don't think that they're one and the same with this airplane that's gone missing.
Well, I'll tell you, Michael, as we've gone through this in a week now, no debris, no leads, report that the engines were running an additional 4 hours. The redirection of that aircraft, it appears now to me that this is a hijack. I think that's the best scenario right at this point in time because of the lack of information or data to indicate that it actually went down. I think, as I understand, it could have been taken to a remote airfield in Malaysia, not Malaysia, but Indonesia, for example, which is where it was wrecked on its last turn. And, you know, there's a lot of airfields out in Asia.
Yep.
So that thing could have been landed by the crew in a remote field. They're in a hostage situation now. Whoever created this scenario are going to wait it out for probably another week before we hear anything. But I think, to me, I'm not a conspiracy guy at all, as you know, but
yep.
I think out of all the scenarios out there, that makes more sense to me than anything. What do you think?
Well, I think you may well be right. You know, the idea that they went low and they turned it off and so forth, and they've got them back at altitude. I think they may have actually changed position again once they went over to that radar unit so that they seemed to have a bead on where they were going, and then, you know, they shut everything down. My concern is that they went low and went off in a different direction, feeling that they were operating in a pretty good stealth mode, given that there's not much radar or anything else in that the neck of the woods, as I understand it. Does that square with your understanding?
Yeah, that makes sense. And if I was doing a sophisticated takeaway of an aircraft like that, it would be very well planned. They knew they could get into the cockpit, for example. They had someone with training that could direct the pilots to go into some low maneuvers and then go into a designated airfield somewhere.
And what do you think the ultimate goal is?
Well, again, probably if it's a terrorist type organization, then you know it's we can do anything. We can take down the Twin Towers. We can bomb any embassy. We can do anything we want to. And so, therefore, be on the mark. The global caliphate will continue if it's a radical Islamist initiative. Some had mentioned maybe even the Uyghurs would be involved, which is the Western Chinese Islamic element. But
are they the ones behind that mass stabbing at the train station?
Yeah. And it could be, again, back to the center of terror, which is Tehran, could be initiated.
Do you think they might want to use that airplane as a weapon ultimately, or they wanted those people for some reason? Could there be contraband in the cargo hold that they wanted to get their hands on?
I think it could be, you know, all of those things. There's just not enough information out now until we can track it down.
And that brings me to my last question on this topic. Why in the world did Kuala Lumpur seem to be so reluctant to share information with everybody? Do you think that there's an involvement with their government? Do you think they're embarrassed?
I don't know.
I mean, why were they so reluctant?
Well, they were reluctant and kept changing their position on it. So there's something a little, what we would call in Brooklyn, Michael, fishy.
Hinky, exactly what I was going to say.
This has a fishy smell to it.
Yes,
but
it does.
It all
smells like
back,
that fish has been out of that back porch for far too long.
Yeah, 7 days now, man. It's stinking.
It's certainly right.
Anyhow,
isn't it?
It's we got to get our act together too, because the studies we've been doing on a potential electronic magnetic pulse attack on Manhattan from a container ship with a Shahab-3 low nuclear weapon on it. We know that's what the Iranians are planning. They know they can take America down in 72 hours with an EMP attack on two or three of our major cities. They now have the capability to do that, by the way.
Do they?
Yes, they do. Yep.
And we have a president that keeps showing weakness. You know, one of my concerns is what happens if the Soviets get upset with us and say, okay, no more hitching a ride on the Soyuz.
Well, there you go. I mean, we have put ourselves
We created all these pressure points that can be used against us, haven't we?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
These are self-inflicted wounds as far as I can see it.
Yep. I think the president ought to step down tomorrow. I think he should resign. I think there should be a no-confidence resolution in Congress and demand that Biden step down, Obama step down, Sebelius, Pelosi, Reid, Boehner, and Mitchell, McConnell, basically the leadership all needs to step down. We need to bring in some bright people with common sense and bring in someone like Admiral Ace Lyons to lead the effort, because here's a guy that knows what's going on. Guys like General McInerney, General Jerry Boykin. We've got some great leaders that can turn this country around very quickly.
You sound like you're ready for the parliamentary system.
Well, maybe that's what we need for a while. It's sure not
working
right now.
You know,
voters
no confidence and show you the door.
Absolutely. They did it in Egypt. I tell everybody when I met with General Sisi in November, the Egyptians showed us how you get rid of your enemy within your government.
It's just so astonishing. You know, the saying that figures don't lie, but liars can figure. I was watching Jay Johnson, the new head of the Department of Homeland surrender. First on March 3rd, he was questioned by Lamar Smith, and then he just got hammered again when he went before the Appropriations Committee on the same issue. They're using statistics of people being turned back by the Border Patrol and claiming them as deportations, and they have nothing to do with deportations. Yeah, they're not here, but there's no consequences if they come back again, whereas if you're deported and you come back, you're looking at jail time. In fact, I think you know, we talked about it. I work with Al D'Amato to make that a 20-year crime if you have a criminal history. So they're comparing apples and cannonballs, and, I mean, every administration fudges and puts spin on things. But these are blatant black and white lies. I've never seen it like this. Have you?
Well, I happened to be with Dr. Ben Carson last night at a dinner, and he talked about so many things that
isn't he an amazing
guy? Going on. Oh, truly amazing. And even Sarah Palin at CPAC a couple weeks ago, that we have people, they have no common sense. The genetic gene for common sense has been left out of their DNA.
I mean it's remarkable.
Incredible. Remarkable. And they're in government making decisions. You know, if you look, our federal government is totally broken.
The legislative branch
is broken. They can't do anything. The executive branch stumbles and lies and has no clue. We're the laughingstock of the world. And then you have a court system. We don't know whatever they're going to decide, but we certainly don't have confidence that they're really going to stand by the Constitution.
Do you ever get the feeling that maybe these justices have a wheel like a wheel of fortune and they spin it and whatever it lands on, that's their decision?
Well, I mean, it's, again, it's a sad
I mean, some of their decisions
and,
seem to make no sense.
No sense at all. I say my theme on my talks now, I'll be making one in Northern California on Monday, is America is at a crossroads.
Yep.
And we need a national call to action to make sure we get down the right road now. We cannot afford to get down the wrong road with the progressives and the people that really don't abide by our Constitution and believe in the American value system. That's what Dr. Ben Carson was emphasizing last night. These people need to lead government. We've got to get them out.
You know, it's remarkable. Mayor Bloomberg, just to give you a quick example, was screaming about how the prosecutors weren't prosecuting people that trespass into public housing in the Bronx. And he was talking about how this brings back crime. And if people are in those buildings, they want them stopped and ask them, who are you, why are you here? And he's right. But when people trespass on America and come to New York, he wanted to give them the keys to the kingdom. And now the current guy, de Blasio, makes Bloomberg look like, a strategist. I mean, I think some of these people lack mouth-ear coordination. Like, I'm absolutely convinced they can't hear what their own mouths are saying. Do you ever get that feeling?
No, I do every day. I just hate to turn on the news every day because it seems to be bad. But, you know, I was like...
Let me ask you another quick question.
Again,
I want to get you back to your friend. What... just talk real briefly, if you can, about Stand Up America.
Well, I formed that with Jerry Mullen. He was the Oscar winner for Schindler's List. He produced the documentary Obama 2016 last election, the year with Dinesh D'Souza. He's coming out with his new documentary, America, in July. I was just with him last night with Ben Carson.
Wow.
But Jerry and I formed it really to be a platform to have people who can examine and analyze threats to the United States, internal and external, and be able to write, be able to produce on television, reports on radio, write articles, do events. And we've been able to do that over the last 8 years, and we're still around, and we're still standing up.
Wow. I mean, you did an amazing job in the military, and you continue to serve this country as very few people have. We're in your debt, I have to tell you, General.
Well, I thank you, Michael. You're a good friend, and unfortunately, I've got to go back into the ICU here and check on my friend. He's a retired Air Force colonel, wonderful guy, and he was out even skiing yesterday. He's 84 years old.
Wow.
And he passed out from a dissecting aorta, but it looks like he's going to be restored, but he's here again. He's too old for them to open him up, so we're hoping he can heal now. And
yep.
Wonderful hero.
Well, you know, you tell me who your friends are, and I'll tell you who you are, and I'm not surprised that you would have a close friend like that.
Yeah, we just drove 4 hours from Montana over to Spokane, Washington to be with him, so that's why we just got here, and I couldn't call you earlier.
No, that's fine. It's a privilege and a pleasure to have you on my program this evening, and I'm sure my listeners out there are happy to have heard what you had to say, but I do want to get you back within the next week or two if your schedule permits. You know, it is so important because, you know, my mission ever since 9/11 has been to educate the American people, because it's increasingly difficult, if not flat out impossible, to find out what's really going on in the world today, and especially what's going on in the United States today. I feel like we have two major news organizations in the United States, Pravda and Izvestia, you know?
Well, Michael, I was going to say, you know, when I look at Benghazi, I would have gone and conducted a rescue operation for those four. We didn't even try. And not that I'm on a rescue mission today, per se, but I was thinking of that driving over. If I have a friend, American in need, I'm going to be there. And we had four people killed, and we didn't even try to rescue them. We've got to get to the bottom of that one.
Well, I agree. And you know, I'll give this a parting thought, and then I'm going to let you wrap up, and I'll continue on, folks. So stay with me, but the general's got things of real importance tonight that he's got to attend to. On 9/11, what struck me was I had been part of a congressional hearing 4 years earlier that focused on the first attack at the World Trade Center and that dirtbag Kansi who shot up the CIA and killed two CIA officers and wounded three others. It took longer to hold that hearing than it took America to win the Second World War. And 4 years later, when 9/11 happened, it only happened because the findings and recommendations that we came up with and that other people came up with after that first attack at the Trade Center were blatantly, utterly ignored. 3,000 people wound up getting obliterated, young people jumping to their deaths.
Mm-hmm.
And when you
mm-hmm.
know that it's preventable and it happens, it leaves you in a state of rage. And I'm going to be honest with you, that state of rage has not left me. And I feel it even more today in some ways than back then, because we are actually more at risk today than we were on September 10th, 2001, in my judgment. Does that square with your judgment? That'll be my final question for you this evening.
Hey, Michael, what difference does it make?
I knew sooner or later I was going to hear that.
And what difference does it make?
Was that the most outrageous statement? What did you think when you heard that? Because to me, I'm thinking, goodness, it's the difference between an accident, manslaughter, and murder. That's the difference.
I was I was incensed. So let me just close on that, that's the reaction and deception we have, and I hope we put her in jail someday. Anyhow, Michael, thank you very much. Have a good program, and I'll come back and do your program hopefully in another week or so.
That would be really fabulous. I hope your friend is well. I don't know him, but send him our best wishes for a quick and complete recovery. And you have a good weekend to travel safely to California.
Thank you, Michael. Bye-bye.
Be well. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Yep. Well, that was General Paul Vallely, folks. Really a privilege to have somebody of that stature and service to our country on this program and to be able to consider him a friend. In fact, I had the privilege of meeting General Vallely when I went to South Carolina and was given the honor of addressing the Tea Party Convention in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, this past January. We had dinner together, we had breakfast together, and we watched each other's presentations at the convention. What we really have in the United States today, folks, is such a lack of leadership and a lack of sense of morality that we have people who seem to think that, outcomes don't matter, that values don't matter. I think too many people, especially in government, have forgotten, as Mark Twain so famously said, we no sooner send people to Washington than they forget who sent them and with what purpose. And we do live in a very dangerous era. And General Vallely is somebody whose background really qualifies him to make the statements that he made. This is really, really very disturbing to me. But what I want to do, I was going to do this before he came on, but he was in a rush because his friend apparently is in the hospital, and I certainly understand priorities. But let me read this segment of his bio that appears on the Stand Up America website, just so that you have an understanding of from whence this man speaks. This isn't speculation. You know, far too many people come on a program, and because they stick a microphone in their face or a camera in their face, they become overnight experts. General Vallely, he was a major general, two-star general, and here is from his bio. Paul E. Vallely, Major General, U.S. Army, retired, born in Dubois, Pennsylvania. He retired in 1991 from the U.S. Army as Deputy Commanding General, U.S. Army Pacific in Honolulu. General Vallely graduated from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and was commissioned in the Army in 1961, serving a distinguished career of 32 years in the Army. General Vallely is a graduate of the Infantry School, Ranger and Airborne Schools, Jump Master School, Command and General Staff School, the Industrial College of the Armed Forces, and the Army War College. His combat service in Vietnam included positions as Infantry Company Commander, Intelligence Officer, Operations Officer, Military Advisor, and Aide-de-Camp. He has over 15 years of experience in Special Operations, Psychological, and Civil Military Operations. He served in many overseas theaters, to include Europe and the Pacific Rim countries, as well as two combat tours in Vietnam. He has served on U.S. security assistance missions on civilian-military relations to Europe, Japan, Korea, Thailand, Indonesia, and Central America, with in-country experience in Indonesia, Colombia, El Salvador, Panama, Honduras, and Guatemala. He has served as consultant to the commanding general of the Special Operations Command, as well as the DOD Anti-Drug and Counterterrorism Task Forces. He also designed and developed the Host Nation Support Program in the Pacific for the Department of Defense and the State Department. He has in-country security assistance experience in Israel, Iraq, Kuwait, El Salvador, Colombia, and Indonesia in the development of civil-military relations interfacing with senior-level military and civilian leadership, and he has been a military analyst on television and radio for over 10 years, guest lecturer on national security, international political and economic issues, strategic planning, matters of global war against radical Islam, and other threats to America. And he had been, for about 7 years, the senior military analyst for Fox News. This guy is the real deal. He's no nonsense. He has a great sense of humor. He's a real fun guy to spend time with, but you understand that he is as focused as a laser on these issues because he knows from whence he speaks. And the threats that we face are not going to go away by happy talk on television. And what I find very disconcerting, to be honest with you, folks, I mean, you look at the background, you look at the sacrifices of his family. His son would have been 39 years old. He was killed years ago in combat in Afghanistan. And we did a demonstration, and I say we, I was just invited, but the D.C. March for Jobs, conducted by the American Black Leadership Alliance. This was back in July of last year. And we probably had no more than 5,000 people there. You know, we are too lazy as a country and too foolish as a people. We expect the military to put their lives on the line for us so that we could sit back in our air-conditioned living rooms on a hot summer day or in the warmth in the winter. We expect law enforcement to go in harm's way to get the bad guys off the street, and most people could care less about the sacrifices being made on their behalf by all these dedicated professionals. The American people need to get off their rear ends and become involved in making certain that the government understands that this is supposed to be a government, as Abraham Lincoln so eloquently said, of the people, by the people, and for the people. And it's about character. And I have to tell you, I mean, just stop and think about it. General Vallely, who's no youngster, he's in his 70s, was driving 4 hours, and he's going to probably make the return trip, I'm going to guess, this evening up in Montana to be with his friend who was quite ill in the intensive care unit. And he very easily could have just blown off my program and sent me a text on the way, or while he was driving, he could have called me en route and said, "Hey, Mike, my friend's in the hospital. I wish I could do your show, but unfortunately I can't." And that's how most people do things. But General Vallely is a man of honor and a man of his word. We don't hear about that sort of man these days too much, do we? A man of his word or a woman of her word. And we spoke earlier today, this morning, and he said to me, "Mike, if you want me on your show, I'd be delighted to do it." Now, this was before he found out about his friend. And rather than blow off the interview, which he could have done, and I certainly wouldn't have been angry with him or upset, I would have been disappointed. It's a delight speaking with him and a privilege to have him on my program. But he could have said, "My friend's in the hospital, I can't make it." Instead, and you could hear the ambulances outside, I suspect he walked over by the ambulance bay or wherever he walked over to make the call. He came on my program and spent 30 minutes with us. This is what commitment is about, folks. We really need to, you know, go back to the future and understand what giving your word is about what standing for principle is about. You know, I look at stories of General Motors, and, you know, maybe they have a good excuse, but I'd love to hear it, about how many hundreds of people were killed because their cars had defective switches and airbags that didn't deploy. But as he said, what difference does it make? Because it's all about profit. It's all about political game. It's all about, you know, some victory strategically in the first person singular. You know, me, myself, and I. Not General Vallely. Not the people of our armed forces. They go out there and they take care of each other. They protect each other and they protect us, we the people. And the time has come for the American people to wake up and say, listen, we are being threatened by so many threats coming at us from so many directions. We keep hearing news reports that we know are bogus, statements being made by leaders that we know are bogus, high-ranking people in the government taking the Fifth Amendment when they go before Congress and they still keep their jobs or they keep their pensions, which makes no sense. You know, I have to tell you anecdotally, when I was hired as an agent, and I was a federal agent for 30 years, they told us at the academy, if you are ever put in a position of being put under oath and being made to give a deposition, perhaps because you did something that's questionable or you're a witness to something or whatever the deal is, under the Constitution, you certainly have the right to take the Fifth Amendment, to say, okay, under the grounds of self-incrimination, I refuse to answer. But if you do that, take your badge out of your pocket, put it on the desk, because we will take it from you. As a civil servant, you do not have the right to refuse to testify. If you do, it will be a ground for removal, for firing. And, you know, you watch the hearings. You see high-ranking members of the government taking the fifth or giving answers that they know were disingenuous, and on and on and on. In March of 2002, I was called by Sheila Jackson Lee, of all people, to testify about one of the most outrageous incidents that I could remember in quite some time. Obviously, next to Benghazi, of course, because that was something else altogether. But for those of you that don't remember it, in March of 2002, two of the dead terrorists of the 9/11 attacks, two dirtbags by the name of Mohammed Atta, who was one of the ringleaders, and Atta and al-Shehi, they were two of the hijackers. And it was discovered to everybody's horror that 6 months to the day after 9/11, they were granted authorization to, of all things, attend flight school. So they had a hearing. And I was one of the four witnesses called before the House Judiciary Committee to testify about how this sort of a monumental screw-up could have happened. And if you watch the tape, and you can go to capsweb.org, michaelcutler.net, go to C-SPAN, you'll see the hearing. It's up permanently. Commissioner Ziegler talked about, he was the commissioner of the INS, he talked about the milestones that would be achieved. By this date, we'll have this in place, and by that date, we'll have some other plan in place, and we're going to have everything tighter than a drum, and America's going to do fine, and everything is under control. And I'm going to tell you, folks, if you watch that hearing and you listen to what Mr. Ziegler had to say, some of those deadlines that he said would be met 13, 12 years ago, whatever, they still haven't accomplished those milestones. This is not competence. And this is about the survival of a nation. This isn't some nice thing of, well, it'll be nice if we built that new road because, you know, the old road is kind of broken down. No, no, no. We're talking about national security, ladies and gentlemen. National security. For those of you that aren't familiar with the phrase that General Vallely used, he talked about EMP. EMP is electromagnetic pulse. It has been discovered that a nuclear-type device, if set off, would generate an EMP. EMP fries electric circuits, would take down the power grid, would take airplanes out of the sky, cars would stop working, your laptop computer would become a paperweight. Anything that uses sophisticated circuitry, computers, that sort of thing, you can throw it in the garbage can. There's no fixing it because basically the pulse goes through it, it melts the wiring, and it fries it. It fries it. Now, imagine the impact on America if a couple of major cities suffered an EMP attack and all their computers and all the electrical power went out, the train stopped running. We're talking about a catastrophe. And they've known about this for some time. And, you know, there's even a potential, and this happened, I believe, in the 1800s, where if a coronal mass ejection, which is a huge solar flare, came off the sun and aimed itself directly at the Earth, and it happened, I believe, in the 1800s, it blew out all the telegraph systems. But back then, that was the big deal for electricity. We weren't depending on electricity for much except telegraphs and a couple of other odds and ends. If it happened today, it would take down the power grid. And for years, there have been people in Washington saying, look, even if the enemies don't do it to us, tomorrow morning an EMP coming off the sun could hit us and knock out the power grids, and it would be catastrophic. Imagine if the refrigeration didn't work, if the trains couldn't bring food, if the water and sewerage systems all shut down. You're talking potentially about the loss of millions of lives. This isn't a game. But, you know, not unlike the Keystone Cops, they run around in Washington, make a lot of noise, and they ignore the problems, hoping that somehow it won't happen. And there's a wonderful expression that hope is not a strategy. So that's why I do the program that I do every Friday night. It's great getting together with all of you. I hope you enjoy our little radio get-togethers. And by the way, EMP would also take out my show, and there's something to really be concerned about, and I say that tongue-in-cheek, folks. I don't want to be the real downer on a Friday night, but we face some serious existential threats. And, you know, it's so remarkable. Around the country, everyone is being told all the stuff about gun control, and I'm not going to turn this into a talk about the Second Amendment, but if you're really that concerned about violence, understand how much crime directly or indirectly is related to narcotics and realize that heroin and cocaine is not produced in the United States. If we can't secure the borders, then that stuff keeps coming in. It funds terrorists, it funds gangs, it funds the cartels, and it fuels violence. If you really want to get to the violence, secure the border, stop the flood of drugs. Heroin is being used, according to studies I've read, twice as frequently now as before President Obama came to office. Twice as many people using it. You would think with that kind of demand that the price would go through the roof. You know, supply and demand, the price has dropped. There's only one way that the price for heroin and cocaine could be going down when more people are using it, and the only way for that to happen is for more of that stuff to be getting into the United States. And now we have an administration that says, let's lower the criminal penalties for people who use narcotics. So we're creating more incentives for more people to use more drugs, and we're not securing the border. What could possibly go wrong? And the money from the sale of drugs is filling the bank accounts of the people that want to do us in. But you see, there's an upside to it, because so much of that drug money washes through the banks and Wall Street and the high-end car business and the high-end jewelry business. So people are profiting across the board, and the banks and the remittance services that move the money get a piece of the action. They don't touch the drugs, but they move the drug money. And when they move the drug money, they get a percentage of the money that's moved. So everyone's literally and figuratively making out like a bandit, and the band played on. Meanwhile, Russia is on the move. China is building its nuclear fleet. They have expanded their airspace so that when our airliners or airplanes fly through their airspace, they're now claiming what used to be considered international airspace to be theirs. So we have to play the game of May I with China. Why? Why is that happening? And we see members of Congress running around saying, well, what's happening shouldn't be happening. And what do they do about it? The president says, I have a pen, I have a telephone. Well, I understand that they didn't talk about telephones in the Constitution, but whatever happened to this notion that you have to legislate laws, not just executive actions, especially when the executive actions are contrary to the laws that are on the books? So think of the quandary this creates. When you tell immigration officers you may not arrest people for violating the law, but you can give them employment authorization, even though there's no justification for giving them employment authorization. We're told that we need to create jobs. Everybody who runs for any office talks about, I'm going to create jobs. I'm all about creating jobs, right? But nobody talks about the fact that every month we're bringing in more foreign workers legally entitled to work in the United States than the number of new jobs we're creating. They wait for those numbers. You know, it's usually on that Friday, and the, you know, whether you're watching Fox or CNN, it reminds me of watching the old Jerry Lewis telethon. You know, let's go to the tote board, Ed. How much money? Well, how many jobs do we create? Same deal, right? Every month we are admitting nearly 100,000 lawful immigrants. These are people with green cards. And yes, some of them are underage and they're not going to work for a while. They're children, but they will, so they're potential workers. And every month we bring in tens of thousands of non-immigrant workers, whether it's H-1B, whether it's the agriculture visas. There's a host of visas. The exchange visitor program, we admit about 500,000 foreign students, most of whom get authorization to work in the United States, and on and on and on. Well, why in the world are we doing that? And then we hear members like Ted Cruz, and if you don't believe me, look up the articles that I've written about it or go to the website. You'll see it. Cruz 5 was an amendment he proposed for S-744, Comprehensive Immigration Reform, that would have increased the number of H-1B high-tech visas for computer programmers by 500%. Comprehensive reform would have increased it by 300%. Nobody talks about that. Everyone just talks about the amnesty side. No one talks about the fact that this would bring in more high-tech foreign workers. Mitt Romney, running for president, said, we need to take all those foreign students and staple green cards onto their diplomas. Why in the world are we educating foreign students when we have men and women in the armed services coming back to the United States, battle-weary at best, seriously injured at worst, where perhaps they could get the training, the education, so they could take those jobs. Why don't we try to help kids living in poverty? Because if you have a child living in a lousy neighborhood, and I spent enough years in Harlem and East New York and the South Bronx, hell holes, that you, I frankly will tell you, would never want to go there if I paid you. And people live in those buildings. And there are rats running through some of those buildings, insects infesting the buildings. The stench is beyond anything you could ever want to imagine. And if you live that way, and 1 in 4 American kids now is believed to be living below the poverty line, 1 in 4, and ask them what the poverty line is. A family of four trying to subsist on something like $25,000 a year? How in the world do you live on $25,000 a year? I mean, in reality, the poverty line is probably double what they claim it is. And if you have a child living under those circumstances who doesn't like going to bed hungry, who doesn't want to live in a building that's falling apart, they turn around and say, well, what am I going to do? I can't get to college. The only alternative very often that these kids think that's open to them is to become involved in crime. So their victims suffer, their lives go out the window, and we wind up building more prisons. Don't you think it makes more sense to break the cycle of poverty and crime and suffering of American citizens in their own country? This isn't the American dream. And the biggest irony for me, ladies and gentlemen, is that the DREAM Act, which is about children, we're told, but really the age cutoff is 31. I'm on the wrong side of 60. 31 sounds awfully young to me. I'd love to be 31 again. But child? That's not a child. It's deception after deception. These are people who ran the border, and I'm going to make a quick point about that also. We're told they're undocumented. The problem is they're uninspected. See, aliens by law are supposed to go through an inspections process to make sure that they're not terrorists or criminals or suffer dangerous communicable diseases or spies or human rights violators or war criminals. Those are the categories of aliens we're supposed to keep out. So if someone sneaks in, how do you know that that person isn't a criminal, a fugitive, a spy, a terrorist? You don't know. And we're being told, oh, listen, if they just came here to work, how do you know why they came here? You don't know who they are. It's not that they're not just undocumented. And undocumented means they can't prove their true identities, which is disturbing enough. Try to get on an airplane and tell them you can't prove who you are. See how quickly you wind up not getting on that airplane. But beyond that, it's also about creating unfair competition for American workers. And nobody talks about it. And everyone is sitting around looking at each other. And to be honest with you, I'm convinced that there are many Republicans that are thrilled with the current situation, just as the Democrats are. See, the Democrats are hoping for new voters, and the Republicans want to satisfy the people giving them their campaign contributions so they can get them the cheap labor that they want. That's what politics is about today. It's not about representing the American people, but about giving the people that make the contributions what they want. And who's taking it in the neck? The average American who can't get a decent job. You know, to talk about CAPS a little bit, Californians of Population Stabilization, they're based out of Santa Barbara, California, beautiful place to be. And this past winter, I have to tell you, I envied them. They being in Southern California with very nice moderate temperature, and here in New York, it's one brutal winter. But we have a lot in common. See, we're told there are 4 border states, and certainly California is one of them. The theory is California, New Mexico, Arizona, Texas are the border states. You know, any state that has a seaport or access to the tens of thousands of miles of meandering American coastline, or any state that has an international airport, or any state that lies along the northern as well as the southern borders are all border states. But California is really getting hammered. They're basically bankrupt. They're in a tough spot. And what's happened to California is making its way across the country. CAPS does a whole bunch of articles worth reading. I really would love for you to go to their website, capsweb.org. During the time of Martin Luther King's birthday, they ran some commercials that were really very good talking about the impact of foreign workers, illegal alien workers, on America's minority communities, whether it's black or Latinos. You know, the other side is quick to make the accusations. Oh, those folks that want the laws enforced, they're anti-immigrant. No, we're not anti-anything. We're pro-enforcement. And those very same immigration laws, ladies and gentlemen, you should know, not only talk about or provide for blocking the entry of aliens whose presence would be harmful to us, and also provides for deporting aliens who commit crimes in our country or who manage to get past the border and they've made their way to the interior. So certainly there's a component of enforcement to that also, and that's very important, and that's what's always been lacking. But those same laws also provide for people to come here legally. The 100,000 lawful immigrants who are admitted every year, that's provided for in those laws that we want enforced. The laws also allow for tens of millions of non-immigrant visitors to come to the United States every year. Those laws provide opportunities for aliens to get green cards and aliens to become United States citizens through the naturalization process. That is all encompassed within what's known as the Immigration and Nationality Act. So when people are pro-enforcement, we're talking about the whole ball of wax. It's not a one-way trip. We accept the idea that, yes, we do want people to come and visit, and yes, we do want some people to come and work, but if and only if they don't wind up displacing American workers. And the only way you know whether that's really happening is if you have the resources to do the investigations inside the United States to make certain that people aren't lying on those applications. And they don't do those investigations. It is extremely rare, extraordinarily rare, for them to uncover the fraud. So understand what's happening. There was a case of a law firm in Manhattan that for 12 long years filed what is believed to be over 25,000 bogus applications for work visas for foreign workers who really weren't coming to work on those jobs, but they were admitted into the United States. Ultimately, they wound up prosecuting, they being the Department of Homeland Surrender, working in conjunction with the U.S. attorneys, they prosecuted something like 24 or 25 people involved with the law firm that was even corrupting people in companies and in other government agencies so they could get the paperwork done. So the aliens came in, and meanwhile this outfit, headed up by a guy by the name of Earl Seth David, were paid millions and millions of dollars. And they were so screwed up that when this guy David realized that something was amiss because they suspended his law license so he could no longer practice law, incredibly, according to a press release issued by the Department of Homeland Surrender and the Justice Department, he went to Canada and continued to mail applications in. He went to Canada thinking this would help to keep him from being arrested. So for a number of years, he sat in an office in Canada and mailed in the applications. Eventually, he and these 24, 25 other cohorts of his were made to plead guilty to just two counts, one count of immigration fraud, one count of mail fraud. That was it. He'll do a couple of years in jail. He had to give back money. Not a word in the press release about anybody looking for the thousands of illegal aliens who were able to get to the United States because of this massive fraud ring. And there are cases where people are being displaced from jobs because the companies lie about whether or not there are available Americans, and nobody does anything about it. So you have middle-class Americans going from middle-class, tax-paying consumers to people losing their homes to foreclosure and becoming members of the increasingly large poor population in the United States. Their American dream is gone. And now we're being told that the American dream is supposed to apply for illegal aliens. And by the way, if you use the word alien on most programs or in the newspapers or whatever, the other side gets crazy and they say, oh, you can't use that word. It's a terrible word, alien. But you know what the A in DREAM Act is? Alien minors. Alien minors. So suddenly the word alien is acceptable if we can somehow tie it in to the American dream for people whose presence here represents a violation of our laws. This is madness. And CAPS has been hammering away at the issues, talking most recently about how President Obama is now saying that we've got to find more humane ways of dealing with people who are illegally present in the United States. And when Jay Johnson did that hearing, as I mentioned, with General Vallely, it's clear that they're cooking the books. over at DHS, taking credit for deportations that really aren't deportations. They're doing it to be deceptive. You know, it's one thing if the policies of an administration are what they are, and if the leaders came out and told the truth and said, this is what we're doing, so people can understand what's happening, and then you sell what your program is. That's what leadership is, and we don't always agree with our leaders. It's just life in the Big Apple. We don't always agree with our bosses. But to use those numbers so deceptively to go out there and say, well, we've deported more illegal aliens than any other administration, when in point of fact they're deporting way fewer, and almost none from the interior, according to statements that were made by Jay Johnson that were reported on, and I believe it was the Washington Times. So we're not getting the truth. So all the assertions they're making to explain why they're doing what they're doing make no sense. It's Orwellian. And there's only a handful of organizations that are willing to go out there and put the information out there to try to educate the American people. This is the mission that I keep telling everybody that I'm on, especially since 9/11. To be here in New York on that horrific day and knowing in your stomach and your gut that it was preventable, if only we enforced the immigration laws, if only we did what was necessary. It's something that I can't get out of my head, knowing what I know. And there's only a handful of organizations that are willing to put the information out there. If you go to capsweb.org, you'll find that information. They're having a water shortage in California. The solution to the water shortage is not to have still more people come in who need to use it for sanitary purposes and bathing and cooking and so forth. There comes a point when you have to say, you know, we have to look out for our own citizens. This isn't being against anybody. And the immigration laws, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, are completely blind as to race, religion, or ethnicity. But the immigration laws are our first and last line of defense. And to go back to that possibly hijacked Malaysian airliner, we'll see how this all turns out. Goodness, you know, Rod Serling, Tom Clancy, or Ian Fleming could have written this script. It's just been absolutely bizarre. But those two Iranians that were on that airplane with those two European passports concern me. And one of the interesting statements that was made by some reporters, as I've been watching the coverage as it continues on its way, wondering where the story is ultimately going to lead us, somebody said, well, they just might be illegal aliens and have nothing to do with terrorism. It's just that they kind of operate the same way. And that's right. And that's why if you're not out there enforcing the immigration laws, you're providing opportunities for terrorists to game the system. And I know the other side would say, well, what are the odds? Well, we only had 19 airplanes hijacked, 19 people involved with hijackings of airplanes recently. That's what 9/11 was. And look at the amount of money and the inconvenience that's imposed on all travelers, because we know that airplanes can be turned into a sort of de facto cruise missile. So if you're willing to spend billions of dollars on the X-ray equipment and make people wait 2 hours before a flight on those long cattle lines and take off the shoes and the jacket and take the computer out of your bag and on and on and on, it's like a whole little ritual that we do. And we do it to keep terrorists and weapons off of airplanes, hopefully. Then why aren't we at least as determined to try to keep terrorists out of the United States? Is it only through airplanes that terrorists can attack us? Think about what happened at Fort Hood. Think about the other terrorist attacks, the Times Square bomber. There are other attacks that have been carried out or attempted to be carried out that did not involve airplanes. To a terrorist, the United States is a target-rich environment. They are limited only by their imagination. Turning a terrorist loose in the United States is like turning a child loose in Toys R Us with a platinum card. But yet, we have politicians. They call themselves leaders, people like de Blasio, who says, oh, we're going to give illegal aliens identity documents. It's remarkable because when you think about it, the police arrest people who sell fake ID, and they issue these great press releases. Anybody who sells fake ID is endangering national security and public safety. They're right, because we all know that bad guys use multiple false names. That is why, folks, when a policeman arrests somebody or a federal agent makes an arrest, you always associate a couple of things happening with an arrest. I mean, think about it, right? The guy gets photographed and the guy gets fingerprinted, and then they ask him a bunch of questions. Isn't that how we always think about the arrest process? God knows I've arrested thousands of people in my career. Fingerprinting, photographing, and filling out the paper. And there's always a ton of paper. I don't even want to imagine how many trees I chopped down in my career. But why do we photograph and fingerprint them? To identify them, because we know that the bad guys have what's known as aliases, fake names. So when you have the city of New York giving people who are here illegally, who snuck into the country, forget undocumented, uninspected. In fact, as an agent, we used to refer to an alien who entered this country by sneaking in as being EWI. Those three initials, EWI, entry without inspection. Very important. They snuck in. They didn't come through the front door. Well, why were they sneaking around? Because they knew they couldn't come through the front door. Why couldn't they? Only known to them. Maybe it's a criminal history. Maybe they're fugitives. Maybe they're spies, terrorists, human rights violators. Who knows? They know. We don't. Now, do you think the city of New York is really going to know the true identities of these people? Of course not. So basically, the city of New York is going to become a competitor for the fake document vendors that are peddling documents on street corners on Roosevelt Avenue. And there's been some amazing articles in the New York Times about it. Because you also associate Roosevelt Avenue with the drug trade and with prostitution. What a combination. And now we top it all off with fake ID. So the city of New York will give out real ID, but God knows what name. And in fact, that's why the Real ID Act was enacted, folks. Because the Real ID Act came about in response to the findings and recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. And isn't it remarkable that with all the talk about immigration, that nobody ever says, hey, let's go look and see what the 9/11 Commission report had to say, because after all, the people who attacked us were all aliens. They all somehow managed to enter the United States. Do you think that maybe there's something significant to that? I'm going to read a quote, and I've read it before, and if I'm being repetitious, please forgive me. But for those of you who have not heard this before, please listen up. Please listen carefully and closely. And by the way, if this program interests you, it is posted in my archives, so it will always be available. And please, please, please ask your friends and neighbors to go to archives at USA Radio and listen to the program this evening. I want people to hear what General Paul Vallely had to say. And list some of my other programs as well. But I want you to hear this statement. And this really sums it up. It is perhaps obvious to state that terrorists cannot plan and carry out attacks in the United States if they are unable to enter the country. Yet prior to September 11, while there were efforts to enhance border security, no agency of the U.S. government thought of border security as a tool in the counterterrorism arsenal. Indeed, even after 19 hijackers demonstrated the relative ease of obtaining a U.S. visa and gaining admission into the United States, border security still is not considered a cornerstone of national security policy. We believe, for reasons we will discuss in the following pages, that it must be made one. That paragraph very closely parallels the written testimony that I provided to the 9/11 Commission. It wasn't written by the 9/11 Commission, but by the 9/11 Commission staff. They issued their own report called the 9/11 Commission Staff Report on Terrorist Travel, a monograph. And these were the investigators and lawyers who worked with the Commission and felt that the commission was very clear about immigration and travel, but they wanted to put even more emphasis on it because they really felt that that was the pivotal issue. So this statement that I just read to you was the very first paragraph of the preface of the 9/11 Commission Staff Report on Terrorist Travel. And if you go to my website, michaelcutler.net, or you go to capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org, you'll be able to download that entire report for free and the 9/11 Commission report for free. I provide links to them in the commentaries that I write. They are free to the public. Click on it, and by the miracle of your computer, you will have it. This is common sense. And there's two other brief paragraphs that I want you to think about. This is on page 47 of that same report, just a short paragraph. Once terrorists had entered the United States, their next challenge was to find a way to remain here. Their primary method was immigration fraud. For example, Yusuf and Ajaj, these are two of the characters, concocted bogus political asylum stories when they arrived in the United States. Mahmoud Abu Alima, involved in both the World Trade Center and Landmark plots, received temporary residence under the Seasonal Agricultural Worker Program after falsely claiming that he had picked beans in Florida. Page 98 has this paragraph. Terrorists in the 1990s, as well as the September 11th hijackers, needed to find a way to stay in or embed themselves in the United States if their operational plans were to come to fruition. As already discussed, this could be accomplished legally by marrying an American citizen, achieving temporary worker status, or applying for asylum after entering. In many cases, the act of filing for an immigration benefit sufficed to permit the alien to remain in the country until the petition was adjudicated. Terrorists were free to conduct surveillance, coordinate operations, obtain and receive funding, go to school and learn English, make contacts in the United States, acquire necessary materials, and execute an attack. And so now we still have these ridiculous arguments about whether or not the border should be made secure. We hear these ridiculous arguments about how we need to educate foreign nationals in our schools, some of whom may well want to use the training we give them as our adversaries, and maybe not even only in the international marketplace where they do, but because they are affiliated with terrorist or criminal organizations. There was a guy who got a master's degree in structural engineering at Texas A&M University. And you know the amazing thing? He figured out a way to secrete money and cocaine in cargo skids, obviously using his training that he had when he studied structural engineering and got a master's degree. He was from Columbia. We are training our adversaries. This is crazy. The schools love it, though, because they want the tuition. And, of course, this displaces American workers, which should never be. Now, I just want to go after one other commonly held myth. And the myth is we're winning, those of us that want enforcement, because they've yet to pass comprehensive reform. And there is some satisfaction there. There is something of a victory, but it's a semi-hollow victory, because if they do comprehensive reform, the damage would be irrevocable. And we're not looking at 11 million. If the 86 amnesty is any guide, we could be looking at, God knows, 30, 40 million. People will come here long after the cutoff date, and since they will not have the capacity to do any face-to-face interviews or field investigations, there'll be no way of knowing when these people got here or who they are or what country they're from. It's lots of blank spaces that we won't know, and it's very dangerous, obviously, but that's what comprehensive reform would do. So the fact that that hasn't passed, that's good, but we're not winning. And I'll tell you why we're not winning, because each and every day, thousands and thousands and thousands more aliens enter the United States, legally and illegally, and they embed themselves in our country. The illegal aliens are illegal from day one, and the people who come here with tourist visas and take a job they're not supposed to have as an illegal alien by virtue of working illegally, or they overstay the visit, or they're admitted to attend school and they don't attend school. There's a bunch of ways that somebody legally admitted can become a removable or deportable alien. And this administration does nothing about it except to provide statistics that don't really tell the story. They cook the books, and the damage is being done to America and Americans. And it goes on every single day. So every single day, people are coming into this country who are potentially criminals, terrorists, or at the very least, people who want to take the jobs of Americans. So how are we winning if that equation hasn't stopped? How are we winning when every time a member of Congress or the administration stands up and debates, well, should we give these people citizenship or just employment? Citizenship or just employment? Well, that's like two different benefits, you know. If you win the lottery, do we only give you a a Ford Mustang, or do you get the Lincoln, you know? Well, I think the Mustang will be just fine. Well, okay, that's less expensive, so that's the cheaper option. That's employment authorization. That's the choice. You have people on both sides of the aisle saying, oh, do we give them citizenship, or we just give them employment authorization? It's the most ridiculous argument in the world, because the message that we are sending to people around the world is that if you come to the United States and violate our borders and violate our laws, we want you to stay. We want to find work for you, and we want to do everything we can so you can stay here and do whatever it is you want to do without worrying. And when you have sanctuary cities, which basically are guilty of aiding, abetting, inducing, encouraging, harboring, and shielding, which if you or I did, are felonies, and you would go to jail for it, nothing happens. So the sanctuary cities, the sanctuary states, Chicago and New York City and New York State and California and Los Angeles and all these other states, they're sending messages out there, and aspiring illegal aliens from around the world hear what they're hearing. And they realize that there's no reason not to come here and violate the laws, because the only debate that's going on is, will they get a green card or will they get a citizenship certificate? This is insane. And then we get to the average American who, even when there are demonstrations, just sits on their hands. People who don't even know who their elected representative is. Any member of the United States Senate who voted for S-744, write it down, Comprehensive Immigration Reform. Any member of the Senate who voted for it, voted for comprehensive reform, which is an oath of disloyalty to America. We're looking at amnesty, potentially for 30 million. There's no cutoff. They're saying 12 million. If it turns out 30, so what? There's nothing that says we're going to stop. In 1986, when they did that massive amnesty program, we were told at INS that we were looking at maybe about a million, maybe a million and a quarter, you know, like that. They were real squishy, because nobody knows. And we wound up with well over 3.5 million. If the same sort of thing happens today, and they're saying between 11 and 12, what's 3 times 12? 36? You know, that's what we're potentially looking at. But we're also looking at a threefold increase in the number of high-tech visas, and for the first time, comprehensive reform that these people voted for would also permit the spouses and adult children of H-1B visa holders, the high-tech workers, their spouses and kids could work on any job, even if it put them in direct competition with American citizens. Didn't matter. They could be car mechanics. They could be librarians, they could be hairdressers, they could be butchers, they could be carpenters. Doesn't matter. They would have as much right to a job as an American. Do you think that's in America's best interest? When we have what kind of unemployment rate? What level poverty rate? This is not the government that Abe Lincoln talked about when he said that America should be a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Paul Vallely's organization has the perfect name, Stand Up America. Indeed, Stand Up America. You know, it's always great joining you at the end of the week, catching up, having these conversations, hopefully providing you with perspectives that you're not likely to hear anywhere else. If you like the program, tell your friends about it. Tell them that they can also go to the archives at the USA Radio Network. This program in particular, certainly I was very proud to have that great American as a guest on my show today, General Paul Vallely. Do hope to get him back in the next week or two. But meanwhile, folks, I want to remind all of you that democracy is not a spectator sport. You really need to reach out to your elected representatives. And what I'm going to suggest to you is something that you should pass along to all of your friends across the country. Primaries are coming. Any politician in the United States Senate who voted for comprehensive reform needs to be taken out of the race in the primary. In the primary. If they voted for it, you know where they stand. They are voting against American families, against American workers. They're voting for legislation that would increase the remittances flowing out of the United States, which increases our debt. And they're voting for a program that would undermine national security. And I don't care what their excuses are. You know, most politicians, not all, there are some good guys. My friend Lou Barletta from Pennsylvania, one of my favorite heroes, Senator Jeff Sessions, Chuck Grassley, Steve King, there are others. But so many of these nitwits, they're not doing right by us. And, you know, it's hard to nail them down. You know, I agreed with it before I disagreed, but I disagreed after I agreed, and sometimes I agree, but I don't agree about when I didn't agree, sort of, kind of. Those are the answers we get from all too many of these characters. But that vote for S-744, that's black and white. That's the smoking gun. That's all the evidence that you need. If they voted for it, they need to find a new way of earning a living. Well, actually, they need to find a way of earning a living because they haven't been earning their living as far as I'm concerned. It's very simple. Do your homework. Whatever state you're from, look at your senator. If that senator, if he or she voted for S-744, they need to go. And you can make them go in the primary. That's the best opportunity you're going to have. And any member of the House of Representatives who supported any kind of an amnesty, any kind of a guest worker or temporary worker or legalization program, look, we have laws that are in place. All that's missing is for those laws to be enforced. We have about 7,000 ICE agents, and very few of them are doing immigration work. New York City has 35,000 police officers. If we enforced the laws, there'd be no crisis. When drunk driving was a problem, they ratcheted up the penalties, and they put more sobriety checkpoints out there telling drunk drivers, we are looking to find you, and if we find you, they'll be held to pay. If this country really wanted that border to be secure, it could be. If we really wanted people to stop coming here to violate the law, we would approach it the same way we've approached drunk drivers and other people that violate other laws. Convince them that the likelihood of being caught is great, and that if caught, they will suffer consequences that they don't want. That's how you solve problems. What they're doing today, ladies and gentlemen, is to encourage ever more illegal aliens to come into the United States. Even though it will undermine national security, even though it will increase the deficit, I don't care when they say it's good for the economy, that's a lie. It's not good for the economy when you take Americans and drive them into poverty so they lose their homes to foreclosure, so they stop paying taxes and start relying on the safety net programs and stop having the expendable income so they can be consumers. And then you bring in more foreign workers and they send more money out of the economy. Last year, between $100 to $200 billion was wired out of the United States. And the UN and the World Bank say, by the way, that if we enact comprehensive reform, the amount of money being wired to the third world from America will go up. How is that good for the economy? How is that good for the average American? You have an opportunity to make a difference. You have an opportunity to have your voice heard. And if you think that just because you're one voice, it doesn't matter, that's not true. Statues are erected in parks across America and around the world, indeed, to commemorate that one individual who at a moment in history took the necessary action to make all the difference. I'm asking you to take action to make all the difference. Become involved. Speak to your neighbors. And if you've become aware of any opportunities for public speaking events, I'd love to come out to your neck of the woods. You can reach me through michaelcutler.net or you can reach me through capsweb.org and they will certainly pass the message along to me. I again want to thank all of you for spending Friday afternoon, Friday evening with me. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend. Stay warm. And please, folks, remember, democracy is not a spectator sport. Good night, everybody.